Ralph Nader is a well-known political activist as well as author, attorney, and former presidential candidate. Among his many achievements is the founding of Public Citizen, a national nonprofit consumer advocacy group founded in 1971. In his address at Harvard Law School on the constitutional crimes of Bush and Obama, he challenged the students present to use their influence to change the trend of the past decade. Here now is Ralph Nader.
First of all, I want to just pay tribute to two people here who are upholding a tradition that is not availing itself of sufficient volunteers, and that's Mr. Roberts, who's, I understand, about the only volunteer keeping the Harvard Law School Forum going, which is a great institution here, and Lisa Ma, who I understand is the main volunteer keeping the Harvard Law Record going. And any of you who want to add your volunteer help and join with them to expand these two institutions that deal with the law writ large, deal with the big policy questions. They don't deal with the technical issues of X10B5. They deal with the major issues, jurisprudential, constitutional, political issues that will affect you and that will challenge your leadership in the future. And any of you who are interested in volunteering, I'm sure they will open the door wide for you. Second, is there anybody from the faculty here? Okay. Third, are there any notables in the administrative hierarchy of the Harvard Law School here who keep the institution going? Okay. How many here are 1L, please? How many are 2L? How many are 3L? Precisely as predicted. That's what the law school does to you. You come in idealistic. You come in idealistic. You actually think the law has some connection with the word justice, which Senator Daniel Webster once called the great work of human beings on earth. And by the time you're finished, if you're not exhausted, you're heading into mostly these corporate law firms who are the power brokers for a great deal of the criminality and the Wall Street shenanigans that have been going on. They are the brilliant geniuses of facilitating the subjugation of the law by raw corporate power, all in the name of the law. Now, we are members of a profession that have historically continued to lie to ourselves. Most professions lie to themselves. A lot of doctors don't think there's much malpractice, for example. And lying to ourselves estranges ourselves from reality. So we live in illusion. We live in illusion that was expressed in September when John Brennan came here. How many of you were in the room when John Brennan was there? See, very few. And he arrived here, and he gave a speech. Now, John Brennan is the assistant to President Barack Obama for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism. And he gave a speech entitled, "Strengthening Our Security by Adhering to Our Values and Laws," end quote. And he dared to come to the Harvard Law School and present a rendition of very nice-sounding values, which were almost entirely fictional in terms of what the White House has been doing. Just the opposite. And Harvard Law School didn't lay a glove on him. And he got away with it. And he got away with it because his audience was fawning, largely fawning over him. It was not this audience. If you want to read it, it's online, and you will see that he makes a remarkable series of statements. First, our highest priority, Mr. Brennan said, is and will always be the safety and security of the American people. As President Obama has said, we have no greater responsibility as a government. Who defines security and safety? Those who cause most of its transgressions. The styles of violence that are described in our country and given highest priority are those that are not responsible to corporate power. They are not traced to corporate power. And so while 3,000 people were massacred on 9/11, which generated a massive counterterrorism business with trillions of dollars in war and armaments and domestic security activities and jobs and consultings and think tanks and equipment. And it was all to keep America safe. Here's what was going on. Every year, 45,000 people dead every year, according to Harvard Medical School researchers, because they don't have health insurance, they can't afford it, to get diagnosed and treated. Every year, 58,000 Americans die from workplace-related diseases, according to OSHA, and trauma. Every year, 65,000 Americans die, according to the EPA, from preventable pollution. Every year, 100,000 Americans die every year due to hospital malpractice, not counting emergency rooms. Harvard School of Public Health study. In other words, there are well over 300,000 Americans who die from preventable causes and certainly should reside under the definition of national security that aren't even part of a single dialogue in any political campaigns of the major parties. They are not the preoccupation of Barack Obama, who has spent more time figuring out how to kill a suspected terrorist overseas in his briefings every morning than he has spent on all of these preventable American deaths, including far larger numbers of sick and injured people who are directly under his authority and responsibility to do something about it. And yet, right after 9/11, the world was on our side. Even our adversaries sent statements of commiseration. And instead of pursuing the backers, the attackers, as a police criminal action, we decided to blow apart two countries and attack other countries, Afghanistan and Iraq, one of the greatest war crimes in American history. And in so doing, we began to immolate our own constitutional rights. Obama said a few days ago in the State of the Union that for the first time in 20 years, Osama bin Laden will not present a threat to the United States. His job was finished a long time ago. He put into motion forces fortified by greed, power, profit, sense of domination, where we're doing it to ourselves. Think of the huge diversions of public budgets to the military and to the so-called war on terrorism that could have been used for child health care, for the renovation of public works, for the protection of the environment, for the advancement of decent education, for the abolition of poverty. We're doing it to ourselves. His work is done. We are two major terrorist strikes away from a police state, the likes of which you will never be able to imagine. Look what one terrorist strike did to us, and we began doing it to ourselves. The problem with law students today is they don't have a high enough estimate of their own significance. Yes, they're often viewed in the literature as confident and boastful a little bit about their intellect and very aggressive and very self-motivated. But what they don't understand is that they're preparing themselves to be spokes in gigantic corporate and governmental wheels. Spokes, well paid. What they don't understand about themselves is their own power, which I'll get to in a moment. The American Bar Association in 2005-2006, led by Michael Greco, who's a corporate lawyer downtown in Boston, issued three white papers, one of which Bruce worked on, claiming that the president then, George W. Bush, was engaging in unconstitutional behavior. Not an episode. Not a single event. Systemic, unconstitutional behavior. Illegal surveillance, Violation of the FISA Act, that's a 5-year jail term. It's clearly an impeachable offense. Systemic signing statements, they thought was an unconstitutional pattern of behavior. He engaged in more signing statements than all the presidents, I think, put together before him. Now, when the ABA, which is the largest bar association in the world, known for its conservatism, can present the President of the United States with 3 white papers claiming that he's been engaging in consistent, unconstitutional behavior, and not get a single courtesy letter back acknowledging receipt, never mind interacting through the Office of Special Counsel or the Attorney General, you can see that what has happened in the last 10 years is an institutionalization of constitutional criminality from the violation of the congressional power to declare war to federal statutes to international treaties to Geneva Convention to national sovereignties abroad. Those 3 reports hardly made a ripple on law schools. We have over 180 law schools in the country. What are they there for? When I was a law student, 1L, we sat in the courtroom there, which we would be there for the speech, but I understand there's a commercial bar cram course that has taken a residence there. By the way, don't ever pick your courses based on your bar exam fears. The bar exam is eminently crammable in more ways than one. Don't say I'm not going to take jurisprudence because of the bar course. So the issue was Robert Hutchins. You may have read, how many of you read the article in the record that I just wrote on the website? Just came out 2 days ago. See what I mean by online? It's nothing like print. For the first time in 70 years, the Harvard Law Record has not come out in print. The Harvard Law Record launched me. It launched the motor vehicle safety. It launched so many careers in public interest law. And it just is being ignored. Now, Hutchins, as you know, I don't know, maybe you don't know, he was dean of Yale Law School at age 29. He was president of the University of Chicago. He came to Harvard to speak to us. And he asked the question, what is the purpose of the Harvard Law School? Everybody sort of snickered and laughed, you know. What the heck kind of question is that? Doesn't he know that the Harvard Law School only has 2 purposes? It's to establish a very smart faculty, the best and the brightest. If you don't believe it, all you have to do is ask them. And to matriculate a very motivated student body? It doesn't have a collective voice. Didn't he understand that? Well, he was dean of Yale Law School, no wonder. He was dismissed. We now have a president, and his predecessor the same, who has arrogated to himself the role of prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner. That is something that might diminish whatever trivial occupations by comparison are involving the faculty and the law students of America. The rationalization of illegality is endless. If there was a dictionary of antonyms to the word infinity, one of the examples would be the ability of members of the legal profession to rationalize illegality from A to Z. The rationalization of illegality sometimes is abrupt and sporadic and challengeable. Joe McCarthy. But when the rationalization of illegality, when the allowance of the corporate state and the military-industrial complex, the former was warned by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the corporate state, called it fascism, 1938, in a dispatch to Congress. And the latter was warned by President Eisenhower in no uncertain terms, the military-industrial complex. When it goes on year after year, it becomes institutionalized. And when criminality becomes so institutionalized, it hardly is a subject for topics by law reviews. That's the way things are. Secret law, secret evidence, no charges, imprisonment without charges, without lawyers, indefinite. This is America? You know, this has to be dealt with instrumentally. We are banking revenge overseas. Before the 13th drone strike killed a suspected Pakistani terrorist a few months ago, a dozen drone strikes killed over 200 people, innocent, in search of him. The banking of revenge sometimes takes a long time to exhibit itself. After all, we supported vicious dictatorships in those areas of the world, repressing their people with our military arms, our diplomatic cover, our vetoes in the UN. And it took a long time for them to say, we're going to strike the U.S. at its homeland. Banking revenge, you will see in your lifetime. And if it isn't physical armaments, it will be biological and chemical. Our country is so vulnerable, it could go down as the most vulnerable country in the world. Subways, pipelines, dams, laboratories, waste deposit sites, radioactive material. We're sitting ducks. The great mistake the public made was that after 9/11, when it was clear that this criminal gang did not have a second strike capability, that's when the war on terrorism was created. And when President Bush said there are Al-Qaeda cells, sleeper cells all over the country, they're well-funded, they hate us, they're suicidal, why didn't they strike? We were defenseless, as we are defenseless to any suicidal attack, because they weren't there. And see, we took a criminal gang and turned it into a major war and an announcement that we would go anywhere, into any country, unilaterally, and wreak our violent will without observing our own constitution and statutes. Now, I'm going to end by just reading the list of violations that have occurred as a result of 9/11. You can have copies of this. It was put together by a great law professor who's too good to teach at Harvard, Professor Jonathan Turley at GW Law School. Don't ever think law professors that don't work at Harvard are relatively inferior. We grew up that way here. They weren't Harvard law professors. They just didn't make it. They didn't quite have it. Professor Jonathan Turley, also a litigator, great defender of the aggrieved, said, in the decades since September 11, 2001, this country has comprehensively reduced civil liberties in the name of expanded security state. They form a mosaic of powers under which our country could be considered, at least in part, authoritarian. And this will take 1 minute. And here are his 10 losses of freedom directly attributed to the reaction of our government and its supporters after 9/11. Assassination of U.S. citizens. You heard that from Bruce Fein. Indefinite detention. 3, arbitrary justice. The president now decides whether a person will receive a trial in the federal courts or in a military tribunal. a system that has been ridiculed around the world for lacking basic due process protections. Fourth, warrantless searches. Five, secret evidence. Six, war crimes. And that, of course, involves such things as immunizing CIA employees from being investigated or prosecuted for such actions. Secret courts, immunity from judicial review, that's spreading, continual monitoring of citizens, and 10 extraordinary renditions, which belies President Obama's statement that his administration will no longer torture. It's just subcontracted, that's all. Those are the 10. Come up and get them if you'd like. Let me end with a brief sermon about law students. The trouble with you is you're behaving as if Harvard Law School is a trade school. High-priced, highfalutin. The difference between a profession and a trade is a profession is ministered to prevent exactly the problem that it is skilled to treat for a retainer. So doctors should be preventing disease and trauma, even though they make money when they have to deal with them. Lawyers should be preventing conflict. We had a great opportunity after 9/11 to wage peace together with a police action enforcement. To wage peace. But the powers that be who realize this have not stepped forward with the requisite moral courage. After the drumbeats to the war in Iraq, where 1 million Iraqis have died at least, we don't even count them anymore, 300 former retired military officers with generals and admirals, and Admiral Shanahan, General Zinni, 300 military officers retired, diplomatic officials retired, and national security retired, spoke out publicly against the invasion of Iraq. The people who could have supported them into a major infrastructure and quadrupled their number in a month to stop this invasion, and that included George Soros, who wrote and spoke against the Iraq war, didn't have the imagination to put a couple $100 million of media and staff behind that in the months before the invasion of Iraq, which could have exposed the lies and the cover-ups and the falsifications of Dick Cheney and George W. Bush, permitted by a compliant media and an inkblot Congress. Could have stopped it in its tracks. A couple $100 million. He makes that in a month. Our leaders to be are you. And you've got to have a higher estimate of your role. Someone once asked me, how many women were in your class, Mr. Nader? 13. How many blacks? Maybe 2. How many Hispanics? Maybe 1. At Harvard, most of the Hispanics were children of Latin American dictators and oligarchs. And so your predecessors fought against the war in Vietnam. They fought for civil rights, sometimes being beaten up and imprisoned in the South. They fought and made the environment a major issue with Earth Day, 1970. They fought to give you not just diversity, but to give you diversity with a purpose. What's the purpose of the diversity other than career gratification? When Mr. Obama was running for president, and I criticized him, and people said, how can you criticize me? You're the first black American. I said, I want to try to make sure that it's not just an upwardly mobile career move. It's got to mean something. You speak with moral authority to working lawyers and faculty and judges. You may not know that. But when in the past law students have put out petitions and proclamations, the rest of the profession knew that those were heartfelt expressions of idealism. They knew that the law students did not have a commercial retainer to motivate them. They knew that the law students did not have an axe to grind. And that's why they knew the law students had moral authority. And you can communicate with tens of thousands of law students over the internet free, which we couldn't back then. And you can mount a movement to restore constitutional practices and the greatest idea of Western civilization, which is due process. Go for it. Thank you.
Ralph Nader, addressing an overflowed crowd at Harvard Law School on the topic of constitutional crimes. After his remarks, there was a brief Q&A with the audience.